to the World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edwin Willett, and this episode's guest, Gerald Brandt. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. My name is Edward Willett, and I am also an author of science fiction and fantasy. My latest books are The Moonlit World from Daw Books, book 3 in my World Shapers series, which takes place in a series of worlds shaped by people from our world to be the kinds of worlds they'd like to live in, and then they live in them. And my main character, Shauna Keyes, has to travel from world to world and gather the knowledge of the making of these worlds and take it to the mysterious Agrair at the center of this labyrinth of shaped worlds. The first book, World Shaper, took place in a version of our world. The second book, Master of the World, took place in a world inspired by the works of Jules Verne, so very steampunkish. And book 3, which is out now, takes place in... it's called The Moonlit World, and that's where it takes place. It takes place in a world where an oversized full moon hangs in the sky all the time, and it's inhabited by werewolves and vampires and ordinary humans who are kind of caught in the middle of the conflict. So that's The Moonlit World. It's out now in both ebook and a trade paperback. My other new book is Blue Fire, which is actually a reissue of a fantasy originally called Flames of Neviana. And it's out under my pseudonym, E.C. Blake. You can find that and many other of my books that have been reissued through Shadowpaw Press, shadowpawpress.com. You can also buy autograph books from me at edwardwillettshop.com. Now, going back to Shadowpaw, one of the books that Shadowpaw published, Shadowpaw, by the way, is the name of our cat, our black Siberian cat, Shadowpaw Press published last year was called Shapers of Worlds. This is an anthology featuring authors who were guests on this podcast during the first year. So Shapers of Worlds is out available now in ebook and trade paperback. It features new stories from Seanan McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, L.D. Modisett Jr., D.J. Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, me, and Shelley Adina. And there are also reprints from John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie Cherneda, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. Now, that one was successfully kickstarted last year at about this time, and in March, I hope to kickstart a Volume 2, which will feature authors from the second year of this podcast. And it's an equally fantastic list of authors. There's 24 of them in all have said they'll take part, and among those are people like, Kelly Armstrong and Marie Brennan and Carrie Vaughn and Nancy Kress and Tim Pratt and S.M. Sterling, and the list just goes on and on. I will keep you posted on that here on the World Shapers podcast, of course, as the details are finalized. And look for that Kickstarter in March. I hope you'll kick in, help make that happen. It's got 18 original stories and only 6 reprints, so it's going to be a bigger and better book. Well, maybe not better, because, you know, awfully good authors in that first book. But it's going to be an equally good book for the second year of my guests. And if that works out, I hope to do a third year anthology down the road. Okay, so I think that covers off our introduction. We'll get on to this episode's guest. Should say that the World Shapers is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and you can find the Saskatchewan Podcast Network online, and you can then visit lots of other great podcasts that originate right here in the great province of Saskatchewan. All right, this episode's guest is Gerald Brandt. Gerald Brandt is an internationally best-selling author of science fiction and fantasy. His current novel is Threader Origins, published by Daw Books, first book in a new trilogy. His first novel, The Courier, which was in the San Angeles series, or San Angeles, I guess, it's Los Angeles, was listed by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation as one of the 10 Canadian science fiction books you need to read, and was a finalist for the prestigious Aurora Award. Both The Courier and its sequel, The Operative, appeared on the Locus bestsellers list. By day, Gerald is a mild-mannered IT professional specializing in virtualization. In his limited spare time, he enjoys riding his motorcycle, rock climbing, camping, and spending time with his family. He lives in Winnipeg with his wife, Marnie, and their two sons, Jared and Ryan. And you can find Gerald online at geraldbrandt.com and on Facebook at Gerald Brandt Author and on Twitter at Gerald Brandt. And we will We will put all those again at the end of this and also at the top in the transcript. So you will definitely be able to find Gerald online. And now you can find him right here on the World Shapers. Hi, Gerald.
Hey, Ed. How are you?
I'm good. Now, we've known each other for quite some time now. Winnipeg and Regina are not that far apart, and we've showed up at the same conventions, and now we share a publisher, Daw Books.
We do. I think we first met probably at World Fantasy in Calgary. Would have been the first time.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I guess we share an editor, too, Sheila E. Gilbert at Daw Books. So,
and two-time Hugo Award-winning editor.
Oh, yes. Must mention that, yes. And the other fun fact is that I was there in Washington, D.C. at World Fantasy when you sold that first novel to Daw. And I think I was one of the first people to know about it, actually, outside of probably your family.
You may have been, actually, yeah. So that whole day is still a fog. I can't remember all the finer details.
It was great. Well, let's start by finding out how you got interested in writing science fiction fantasy. Let's take you back first to a little bit of biographical information. Did you grow up in Winnipeg? Have you always been a Winnipegger? Or? Tell me your life story.
I did grow up in Winnipeg, although I wasn't born here. I was born in Berlin, Germany, so I'm a first-generation immigrant to Canada. But I guess we moved when I was 2 years old. So, I don't remember much of my first 2 years of my life. Winnipeg has been my home for pretty much my entire life.
So growing up in Winnipeg, when did you discover that you liked science fiction?
This is going to sound cliche, and I'm sure that just about everybody you have spoken to has said the same thing, but I started out as an avid reader, right? Don't we all?
Pretty much, yeah.
And the books that grabbed my attention, although I read pretty much everything, you know, if you handed me a ketchup bottle, I'd read the ingredients list just to read something. But the books
and then do
that
it again in French, since we live in Canada.
So. Well, no, no. I'm sadly a one language person, but I did not do well in school in French classes. The books that really seemed to draw me more than anything else were mainly fantasy novels and science fiction as well. So it, you know.
Do you remember any specific titles that had an impact on you?
Oh, my gosh. The Foundation series, Asimov's Foundation series, was a big one for me. Going a ways back. In my younger years, Piers Anthony was a big one for me, but I find myself struggling to... I went back and read some of him recently. And I don't think his books aged that well, unfortunately.
No, I loved them too, and I had kind of the same reaction when I looked back at them.
Yeah. So what else? You're asking me to go way back. You know, I'm pretty old.
Old, yeah. Look who's talking to me. I'm older than you are, so, you know, I can remember. I'm sure you can.
Well, maybe... But yeah, I don't even have many of those books on my shelf anymore. I've gone past what really got me into the genre, I think.
Well, when did you start writing? I read in another interview, I think, that you did some in junior high.
Yeah, in junior high, I started thinking that, you know, while I'm reading all this stuff, I can start writing it, and it was much like the poetry I was writing at the time, rather angst-filled teenage garbage. But, you know, I guess we all start somewhere.
How much did you do? Like, were you writing long things or short stories? Or?
Yeah, short stories, I didn't even know they really existed back then. So, I was reading novels and, you know, I was reading Stephen R. Donaldson and things like that. So I was basically copying what I read and... I got well into some novels, but I never actually got anything finished back then. I think I actually still have a notebook here somewhere that has a really bad 100 pages of handwritten fantasy novel in it, which I really should get rid of before I die because somebody will read it and that would just be bad.
I have actually right here on my desk, I have uh, the the handwritten manuscript of my first novel that I wrote when I was 14.
Oh boy.
And it was typed up later, and you never know. I might put it online sometime just under a pseudonym or something, and my worry is that it will sell better than my actual novels.
You are a braver soul than I.
I don't know. I haven't done that yet. I've talked about it for a long time. It hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
So I also read in that interview, though, that you kind of then, well, first, before I do that, did you share your writing with people at the time? I always ask people that about their youthful writings. Were they brave enough to share it, or was it a thing you just kept to yourself?
Never. I did not share any of my writing until I got quite serious about it when I turned 40. And even then I held off for a number of years before I thought I was good enough to have somebody else look at.
So there was a gap in there between
there was.
Writing in junior high and getting serious about it. What happened in there?
Well, in grade 10, so the first grade of high school, they offered a computer programming course. And on a whim, I took it. And that was the end of my world. I started a career of computer programming. And I'm glad I did. It did very well for me. I'm actually not programming anymore. I've gone more to the IT side now. But it gave me a career. It helped me, let me raise a family and buy a house and do all those things that normal people do that you can't do in most cases, with a writing career.
I did programming briefly. I didn't have a class in it, but I learned BASIC, and I had a Commodore 64. And I wrote this extensive program using the Commodore 64's music chip that allowed me to input sheet music into it in after a fashion. And I did that, and it took hours and hours, and it worked after a fashion. And then when it was done, I thought, there are other people who are better at this than I am. And I was never tempted to be a programmer after that. So I had a different reaction to you, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, my first introduction in high school would have been punch cards on and programming in COBOL before we moved on to the Commodore PET, which was the first microcomputer I touched. So that was a long time ago.
I did take one programming class. I lied. I took an off-campus university programming class, and it used a Commodore PET as well. So there's something we have in common. But then you did something with it, and I never did. So what brought you back to writing then? I mean, and were you continuing to read science fiction through all those years?
Oh, absolutely. I my reading has never, I'm not going to say never. My reading did not drop off at all during those years. That has changed since I've become a writer because I just don't have as much time as I used to have. I absolutely kept on writing, kept on reading. I wouldn't have stopped. Nothing would have stopped me from reading.
I kind of lump science fiction and fantasy together, but your writing is certainly, so far at least, more on the science fiction side. Were you more of a science fiction reader than a fantasy reader, or were you indiscriminate?
I was more a fantasy reader than science fiction. And everything that I've ever written before my first sale has been fantasy. But I have never sold any of my fantasy. I've only sold my science fiction. So go figure.
Well, how did the switch to writing seriously come about? What made you decide at the age of 40 or whenever to take it seriously and really get into it?
Yeah, it was always there. I mean, always the idea that, I'm reading this stuff and I can do this. I want to do this. At 40, a little bit before 40, I became a stay-at-home parent to my two boys. One was in grade 1 and the other one hadn't yet started preschool, I guess, so he was home all the time. And one of the parents of another kid in my son's in the grade 1 class, she was a writer. And, we started talking a little bit, and I just kind of woke up one morning and said, this is it. It's now or never. I'm 40 years old. If I don't start writing, then I probably won't. So I gave myself a goal. I said, I will have something published. A novel was my goal. I will have a novel published in 10 years, or if I don't, I'll stop, because it's obviously 10 years to me was the perfect amount of time to hone whatever skills I might have had and churn out something that was publishable. And the end result was Sheila offering me a contract at roughly 10 years and 3 months.
So close.
And at that point, I wasn't going to stop anyways, because 10 years of actually struggling and getting better and writing and being critiqued and critiquing, I wasn't going to stop at 50 at any rate. I was going to keep on going until I had something sold. But it's interesting that it happened roughly in the time frame that I gave myself.
Did it just sell out of the gate, or was there some back and forth with Sheila on that particular novel?
Well, there's a 5-year story.
Yeah, I kind of knew it was there. That's why I asked.
I figured you did. I actually, Sheila came to a convention, KeyCon, here in Winnipeg.
Yeah, I remember I was there.
Also, we did meet then before World Fantasy,
I
but we
guess so.
probably never spoke.
Yeah, I probably didn't notice each other, but
Probably not, no. But anyways, as a big surprise to her, KeyCon had set up a pitch session, which she
I
was,
remember that too.
not prepared for. So I signed up for the pitch session, and it was my first pitch session ever, and it took me by surprise, probably almost as much as it took Sheila by surprise. They put 30 of us into a room with Sheila, and we all pitched to her in front of each other, which is not actually the way it works, really. But whatever, it happened. I unfortunately followed somebody who had had a lot to drink the night before, and showed up with bathroom tile imprints still on the side of their face, and they tried to pitch to Sheila and finally just stood up and said, "I'm sorry, I can't do this," and walked out. And then they called me. So I went up to the desk and did the brief introductions, and she said, "What do you have?" And I stuttered and stuttered, and I said, "I'm really quite nervous, and I'm not sure that I can remember what I memorized anymore." And she says, "Well, do you have it written down?" And I said, "Yeah, it's right here." And she just looked at me in the eye, and she said, "Oh, thank goodness." And she took the paper and she read it, and she requested a full. Then I guess we met. That's when I started going to World Fantasies, probably. We met at every World Fantasy after that and talked about the book. She never actually had read it yet, but she asked me what I was working on, what was new, what was coming up, I guess she was kind of just fishing me out to make sure that I was serious about work, about writing, and that this is what I wanted to do. In the meantime, I pitched other books to her, and she kind of grimaced once or twice. Threader Origins was one of those, but I wrote it anyways, despite her grimace. And then, we'd meet, and she said, "I managed to read your synopsis on the airplane. So we're going to talk about your synopsis rather than the courier." And so she critiqued and poked holes in that, and I kept saying, "Well, this is what happens." And so I answered all of her questions on that, and the next year she actually read it and bought it. But it was a 5-year process.
That's an interesting sale. I remember because I was at KeyCon. I was working on Magebane at the time, which is under one of my pseudonyms, Lee Arthur Chain, and I actually remember after Sheila had finished her editorial comments on that, saying to her on the elevator, "But I can't write, can't
In Washington, when she bought the Courier, I left our little meeting, and we arranged to meet later on in the day again. So I went up to my room, and I phoned the wife, and she actually left a meeting to take my phone call, and she went back into the meeting. And she says, "My husband just sold his first novel." And everybody in the meeting, including her boss, looked at her and said, "Well, you're not quitting your job, are you? So, luckily, she said no because the writing, you know. But anyway, in that same convention, Sheila and I sat down in a quiet spot, and she gave me my first editorial on the novel at that convention. I kind of felt like garbage because I didn't know how things worked. But so same as you, I can still write. You think I can still write, right? And then about 20 minutes after she gave that first editorial pass, I went to my first Daw dinner.
When I've said that to Sheila, it's been, well, you know, I bought the book, so obviously I think you can write.
So. Yeah, I think Julie Sharnada has asked her to at least say something good right at the beginning so that we actually start off thinking, okay, maybe it's not that bad.
Well, we'll talk about the editorial process at the end of this next bit, because that is part of the whole being a published author thing that people are interested in. But let's talk about now how we'll focus on the new one, Threader Origins, okay, which just came out as we're recording this, and will have been out for a month or so when this goes live. Using that as an example, tell me the classic question: where do you get your ideas? Or if you prefer, what was the seed for this particular novel? How did this particular one come along, and how does that tie into the way that ideas normally bubble up for you?
This is my second series with Daw, although I have a bunch of trunk novels, so I guess I have experience there as well. But normally, and is the case for this one, have a character.
Before we do that,
yes,
very important, give us a synopsis so that people know what we're talking about.
The dreaded synopsis. How writers dislike that part. But Threader Origins is an alternate Earth book. Darwin Lloyd is a university student. He's going to become a physicist, and he loves quantum theories and all that stuff. And he's following in his father's footsteps. So he gets an internship where his dad works, and together with, of course, the whole team, they build a machine that can basically generate unlimited electricity to power, you know, whatever you want, a whole city or whatever. And Darwin is there for the very first test where they go up to 100%. Things go wrong, and he gets pulled into an alternate Earth by the machine, and things go bad, you know, from there. In the world he gets pulled into, the same machine was turned on 5 years prior. So they've had 5 years of this machine generating what the people call threads, and it can not only not quite alter reality, but it can kind of predict the future, and it can do various things. I won't get into too much detail here. And he sees how much it's destroyed the world he's gone into, and his main goal is to get home and turn the machine off. And of course, nobody knows how to do that, get home or turn the machine off. So it's a struggle.
The overall story is called The Quantum Empirica, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Now go back to, where did this one come from?
All right. We'll go back to, again, Darwin Lloyd was just kind of popped into my head one day as not quite a fully formed character, but pretty close. And I fleshed him out and figured out what his flaws were, what happened to him before the book started. And I figured I had a great character to build a novel around. So it took me quite a while to figure out what kind of world to throw him in that would test him the most. And once I did that, I just started researching and writing.
Well, what is your planning and outlining process look like? I read a description of it, and it sounds quite, physical, lots of post-it notes and things like that. So how does that all work for you?
All right. I bought a 4x8 metal whiteboard at IKEA, and I have so many stacks of post-it notes around here that it's ridiculous. But basically what I do is I by the time I'm into the post-it note stage, I already have my main character and I have the majority of my world thought out, not necessarily detailed, but thought out. And I might have a couple of secondary characters. And I grab my post-it notes and I write. Sometimes it's as little as one word, and sometimes it's a sentence. And I take that and I stick it on the board. And basically that post-it note becomes a scene. And sometimes the one word is an emotion, right? I know that at this point there's got to be a lot of pain and hurt, so that's what I'll put in there because I don't know what scene is going to bring that out yet, the details, but I know that I need it, so I'll put it on there. And, you know, by the time I'm done, I have anywhere from 75 to 100 post-it notes or more on my whiteboard. And it's possible that they're all different colors because I assign a color per point of view character. So for say, for example, on the San Angeles series, I probably had about six colors on my whiteboard. For Threader Origins, it's just all Darwin Lord's point of view, so it's all one color. In this case, it's pink. I'm still staring at it now for book three. And once I have all my post-it notes written, I arrange them to make more sense. And so I know where I have my highs, I have my lows, and I don't know chapter breaks or anything at that point yet, but I actually do my initial rough plot on that whiteboard. Once I'm sure that I have something that I like, that is somewhat coherent, I take all of those notes and put them into a spreadsheet, and again, color-coded based on character point of view. And that's where I start expanding things. For the San Angeles series, every scene had a timestamp, so I made sure that the timestamps matched for every point of view character and all that stuff. For Threader Origins, I had separate color codings for the threads that Darwin was learning at a time, because the color of threads have specific meaning in the novel. So I fill all that in, and I take those one word or those one sentence scenes, and I put them into three or four sentences in the spreadsheet, and I just build it and rearrange it until, again, I'm happy with it. And then I take the somewhat detailed description of three or four sentences, move those into a document, and start writing from there. I usually end up with, by the time it's all said and done, 72 to 75 scenes, because I average 1,300 to 1,400 words per scene, and that gets me a 100,000 word novel.
Wow. Not the way I work.
Well, and you know, the thing is that none of what I've done up to this point is written in stone. And which is good, because as you're writing, these things just organically kind of grow. I don't leave, at least for the first half, I don't normally leave my plot. But there's these little details that come in. This character that you have to throw in there in order to show something becomes a little bit more important. So you know that they're going to be coming back in the book a bit more. So usually at the halfway point, I go through the process again for the second half of the book, because things have changed enough that the second half of the plot, although it's the plot's probably okay, it's the details of the interactions and the emotions that might have changed. So I go back usually at the halfway point, and rearrange that second part of the plot.
So this post-it approach, how did you decide to use that approach? Does that somehow relate to being a computer programmer and the way that you plan out when you're programming, or?
No, not at all. Actually, you know. When you're starting out, and again, during that time period when I wasn't writing, but I was doing all the computer stuff, I'd still buy all these books on how to plot and character development and all this kind of stuff. My bookshelf is filled with them. But the thing that made sense to me was people were always using note cards, right? And they're saying you take the note cards and you write things down on the note cards, and that lets you rearrange things. And I tried it, and it didn't work for me. But, you know, and then I moved to post-it notes, and just seeing it visually on the whiteboard all at once worked for me a lot better than having a stack of note cards that I would rearrange or have to lay down on the floor to look at the look at the sequence of events, and then at the end of that, have to clean it up because, of course, I have kids and a family, and and I can't leave stuff like that on the floor. So yeah. it's kind of a progression of the note cards just into Post-it notes.
So you're like, this, your novel doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah, well, the cat ran through it just the wrong moment.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's I read all that stuff too in the magazines, and yet it never took with me at all. So I'm always interested, you know. And part of the point of this whole podcast is that everybody does it differently, so it's always interesting. Right. So once you start writing, it's sequential because you figured it all out ahead of time. What's your actual writing process? I know, for example, that you use a rather different word processing software than most people do.
I do. I tell the world I use WordStar, which is a 1980s word processor. But, you know, having been a computer programmer for too many years to even consider, I wrote my own word processor, and I use that, and it's WordStar compatible.
And what is your actual – first of all, what do you like about that? What were you looking for that made you do that?
The first thing is that the muscle memory of just how to use WordStar, because I used it like in the 80s and early 90s. I used it for all of my other stuff, whether I was documenting or whatever, I was doing some code or whatever, I used WordStar. So the muscle memory was certainly there. But it's really a writer's word processor. If you have Microsoft Word, if you highlight a block of text and you know you want to copy that somewhere, or you want to do something with that text, but you're not quite sure, and then you go and do something else, that block of text is not highlighted anymore, right? So you kind of lose what you've highlighted. With WordStar, I can highlight a block of text, and then I can write for 6 hours. And I can say, oh, that block of text, that belongs here. And boom, I can copy it in. It's still highlighted, right? So it remembers things like that. It also has bookmarks. It has 10 bookmarks. So I can say, remember this position in the document as bookmark one or whatever. And then if I'm writing, I can go, oh, okay, I have to remember. I go back to bookmark one, and it's one key press, and I'm back at bookmark one. And I can go, and then I can go back to where I was writing. So it's easier to jump around. It's almost like you have a printed document with your fingers in between pages, and you're flipping between chunks of document to make sure things flow. It just seems to work better for me.
Hmm. Well, when you're writing, where do you write? Do you just... And how do you find the time for it? You do have a full-time job, so how do you juggle all that?
I do. I had a full-time job up to the second book in the San Angeles series, and the schedule on that was so tight that things were not working out for me. So I actually went down to 3 days a week on my job, that helped a lot. But then, of course, with this whole COVID thing going on, and me being the IT guy, my workload increased because nobody's working in the office anymore, so I have to support these people in their homes and stuff like that. So I'm now back up to 4 days a week. So close to full-time, but not quite. So I got into the habit of writing at 5 in the morning for the Courier because I was the stay-at-home dad at that point, and my kids woke up at 7. So that gave me a two-hour block when nobody was awake. I could just come into my office and sit down and write. Over time, that has kind of disappeared, and I started writing in the evenings, and because the kids got older or whatever, I started writing in the evenings and on weekends. The current book I'm writing, which is the third in the Quantum Empirica series, I tried dictating, which worked for a while. But I've now gone back to 5 in the morning writings because it just seems that I'm more creative at that time. You try to get up at 5 in the morning, try still being the keyword, write for a couple of hours before, the whole house wakes up.
Are you a fast writer or a slow writer?
Depends on what I'm writing. If I'm writing an action scene or something with a bunch of dialogue, I can churn that out pretty quick. If I'm writing something, in between those, where a character has to get from A to B and stuff like that, I struggle with those ones. And if I get 200 words, 300 words, 600 words in those 2 hours, I'm happy. But if I'm doing action scenes, I can do 3,000 words in those 2 hours easily.
So once you have a first draft, what does your revision process look like? What things do you do on the, and yeah, how many passes do you make and all that sort of stuff?
How many passes I make is, anywhere from, double digits. Let's just go double digits and leave it at that.
It's hard to tell when you're working. It's kind of an organic thing, really, what you count as a pass.
Although I do have fixed passes in there as well. I have a specific pass where I add description. Because when I do my first draft, I'm not a descriptive writer, right? My first draft could be anywhere from 65 to 75,000 words, which is not the right size for a novel. It's too small. One of the passes is adding the description so that you can actually get know where you are in the book when you're reading it. And another pass I add, I use specifically for emotional content to make sure I'm hitting those points. And then I have the technical passes as well, don't use passive voice and all that kind of stuff. And there are the organic passes where you're just kind of going through it, and it is tough to keep track of. But I don't revise as I'm doing that first draft. I don't go back ever. I get the words out because I can't fix what's not on the paper. So I've got to get that first draft out before I start any revision. So that first draft is usually quite rough.
And how long does your revision process usually take you?
That all depends on when the contract says the book is due.
I guess I'm done revising. Yeah, I know that feeling.
That's a tough call because it's different for every book, really. It all depends on the details that I need to remember. For the first, the San Angeles series, every scene had a date and a timestamp. And I will never, ever, ever do that again because that is a headache. I ended up using Gantt charts in order to keep track of who was where and when and what they knew just to make sure that those timestamps were actually accurate. And that was a struggle. So that took a lot of revision, right? So that took more time. And in this one, because it was a bit more of a, it's not as strict on its timelines, really. So the passes were, how long it takes, this is how long it takes. Don't think I can answer that.
Well, you did, kind of.
Well, kind of.
So once that deadline comes along and the book goes in, what do you find? Well, why don't you describe what Sheila's editing process is for you?
All right. Before I go into that, I will say that Sheila is thankfully, happy to give you an extension if you need it. And I have used that twice now. I used it for the last book in the San Angeles series, and it made me feel so bad that I swore I would never do it again. And so I did it again on the last book in the Quantum Empirica series.
I may have taken advantage of that once or twice.
Yeah. and for this extension, I blame 2020. I take full responsibility for it, of course, but 2020 was quite hard on my creative process. So that's why book three was is late in being handed in, but it will still be the books will still be released in a nice timely fashion, simply because I'm ahead of the game already, right? With first book being out and third book being halfway done, right? I still have time, so things are the book will be released in a good order. But the process for dealing with Sheila, you read about how everybody goes and they talk about the editorial letter and all that stuff. So that's what I was expecting. But that is not the way that Sheila works. As you well know, Sheila will call you up on the phone at a pre-planned time. And you will be on that phone for however long it takes for her to go through her notes. And she will go through and tell you what is wrong with your book. And it's all verbal. It's all done on the phone. And for my first two books, I was scribbling away so fast I might have missed half of what she said. At which point, because she always calls me on my cell phone, I have an app on there now that records our phone calls so that I can always go back and listen to what she's saying again, because my notes miss things. Mm-hmm. You just can't keep up to it. She's a fast talker, and you can't, my handwriting's not fast enough to keep up with her.
And what sorts of things are you generally, does she generally suggest to you you might need to expand upon or revise? It's different, I think, probably for every author. So,
yeah, and I think it's different for really every book I hand in, right? I've never actually looked for a common thread, which is probably a weakness of mine, because if there was a common thread, I should really fix it, shouldn't I, before I hand the book in. But,
I usually find it's like, expanding on something that there's just not enough information there for the reader to follow what's going on, yeah, or that sort of thing is common.
Yeah, I would agree. They're continuity comments or things where there's not enough detail to explain why the character's going this way, or there is enough detail and she doesn't think that it really fits in with the character's psyche or of what she's learned of that character, and she doesn't think it fits. So I'll take an example. The first version of Threader Origins that I handed in, the relationship between Darwin and his father was antagonistic. They did not like each other. They blamed each other for a lot of things, which I won't get into detail with because that's a bit spoilerish. But they butted heads a lot. They didn't really like each other. It created tension and it created conflict and it moved the book ahead. So it did its job, but when Sheila read it, she didn't quite like it. She didn't think that was really what the book needed. So this is the nice thing about doing phone calls. We sat there and we just hashed it out. We figured it out together, and she kind of tossed in ideas, and I said, that won't work because of, and then I tossed in ideas, and she says, well, that might work, but what about, we came to something that we were both quite happy with. And that relationship changed, and because it changed, it added so much more depth to Darwin's and the father's character, and increased the whole emotional line of the novel, that it was just fantastic.
Before you were writing seriously, or when you started writing seriously, did you have any fear of the editorial process? I know that some beginning writers, the editor's going to change everything, or they're going to ruin my story.
Yeah, way back when, I didn't even know there was an editorial process. So no, my first experience with the editorial process would have been with Bundoran Press, when Virginia O'Dine ran Bundoran Press. Hayden Trenholm edited Blood and Water for her. And they bought a short story, my very first sale ever, in 2012, maybe. So Hayden was my first editorial process thing. And
another editor again, we've shared.
Yeah, and I loved working with Hayden. He was, I expected the editorial process to be, at that point anyways, this is wrong, this is how you can fix it. And that's not really the way it works, because the editor didn't write the story, right? It's my story. So what the editor and Hayden and Sheila will both do is they'll say, this isn't working. What can you do to make it better? This spot feels a bit forced to me, or this spot feels weak, or I'm not getting the emotional hit I think I should hear. But they didn't tell you how to fix it, right? They just tell you that it's not working, and then you have to go back and fix it. And that, I think that was the biggest surprise for me when I first, with Hayden and when I first actually started thinking about the editorial process, is that they leave it up to you. They don't do the changes for you.
But if you wish to consult with them about possibilities, they're certainly willing to help out in that regard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can, and that's what they're there for as well, is to hash things out if you need them. And as I mentioned about Sheila, she's very, very good at that. With Hayden, I didn't do that as much. So,
one thing I forgot to ask you about was, at the point at which you have something that's almost ready to submit, do you use beta readers of any sort, or do you have a writing group or anything like that?
I have a loose writing group. We actually used to be a critique group, but that I had to bow out of that because my timelines were so tight I couldn't read somebody else's work and do a critique. So I didn't feel like I was giving into the critique group as much as I was getting out. So I had to pull away from that. But that group instead just became a general writing group. And we will talk and discuss ideas. You know, if I'm hitting a roadblock, you know, I'll say, my character's been in this location for so long and I can't get him out of there. What am I supposed to do, right? And we'll hash things out verbally as we meet. But it's not a formal critique group. But I do have beta readers, for sure. I have a handful of beta readers that I trust and respect their opinion. And they get everything before I hand it in. And even then, you know, they'll give their feedback, and one beta reader will absolutely hate a section. And every other beta reader, I mean, beta readers will never tell you they loved a section, almost, never. But they didn't bring up the section at all. So I'll kind of go, okay, well, one person out of however many didn't like it. I'll read it and I'll say, no, this is perfect for the book. I'm leaving it in as is. Or I'll read it in context of their opinion and I'll say, no, he's right. I could do this and this and this and it would be a better scene or a better section. But normally if one person picks something up, it's gone. It's not something that you're going to change. If multiple beta readers pick up the same thing, then I know I have a problem.
See, I've never had beta readers, still don't have beta readers, so I always ask about them because it's just, I've never been someplace where I felt I could find them. Now, I probably could online now, of course, but when I started, I was in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, and, you know, as I've mentioned before on here, the writing group in Weyburn at the time consisted of elderly women who wrote stories about the Depression, so it didn't really fit in there.
No. Yeah, just a couple of my beta readers are actually local. Most of them are spread far and wide. In fact, I don't even know where two of them live. I just know they're in the States. That's all I know.
I was part of a writing, not an online, but a by mail critique group for a while back in the dark ages. But boy, that was a slow process.
Yeah, at the beginning, I did join an online critique group, and I think they're actually still running because I still get some emails from them occasionally. But that was also, I found, a slow process. I can't imagine doing it over mail. That would be a struggle.
Yeah, it was slow. But I did find a couple of really good – I ended up with a couple of really good people, and I guess we were sort of beta readers for each other at that point. We didn't call it that back then. But yeah, I just never got in the habit of that, and I keep thinking – maybe my books would be better if I did. But, you know, I'm kind of set in my ways at this point. So.
You know, us old guys, we're stubborn.
Yeah. I never did it that way. I'm not going to start now.
That's right. Get off my lawn.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, we talked a little bit about the characters. When you're doing all this stuff, do you write down character sketches? Do you have, and you know, do you just sit and think about the character and try to build all the backstory and everything at that point? Or does a lot of it get discovered as you write, or how does that work for you?
You know, although I do start with a fully fleshed character, I do not have a lot of their background. And I also have no idea how they look. If you read my novels, you'll find that I almost never describe what my characters look like. I rather have the reader do that. That might be because I don't really know how they look like. I might have an image in my head, but it's still kind of blurry. But yeah, the character, although I have a full-fledged character when I start, I don't know their backstory, and although I kind of know their emotional arc going forward, I discover that as I go. It's not part of my plotting process, not part of anything. The character develops as it goes. And then in the revision process is when I'll go back and make sure that there's consistency in all of that.
And the other thing I kind of forgot to ask you about, and especially this one, which, you know, like quantum multiple universes and all that sort of stuff, what kind of research do you end up doing for most of your books?
This is a question I really hate with the Quantum Empiricus series specifically.
Sorry.
I also get asked it a lot because it is, you know, quantum strings and quantum theory. I ended up buying many, many books and doing a whole bunch of online research into quantum theory and quantum strings, and yeah, and I I realized, much to my chagrin, that I'm just not smart enough to know that stuff. For the Quantum Empirica series, what really worked is one of the books I bought was The Dancing Wu Li Master. I don't have the author's name in my head right now. But it's quite an old book. But it kind of brought Eastern philosophies together with physics and kind of tried to meld them together into something that was explainable. And that really fed into Threader Origins. In fact, the title of the book was The Dancing Wu Li Masters, and I actually have dancers in Threader Origins based off of that. I had a friend, I was reading the book and going through it with highlighter and marking pages, and a friend picked up the book and started reading my highlighted comments, and he threw it back on my desk in disgust. He says, "You haven't highlighted any of the scientific stuff, just all the emotional content." I said, "Well, yeah, okay, that works." The research is, because both of my series take place, basically on Earth, I don't have any extra, planetary stuff. And, and especially for Threader Origins, Google Maps was a big one, big part of my research. And then I had the opportunity to actually, I went on holiday and drove through most of the areas that Threader Origins covers in the U.S., which also helped me bring in a bunch of extra details on the scenes.
Okay, well, we're getting down to the last few minutes, so I'll ask you the other question you've already said you'll hate, which is the big philosophical questions.
Did I not mention that I'm not intelligent enough?
Before we started, you said you weren't philosophical enough, so we'll see.
Well,
but they're really not difficult questions. The first one is, why do you write? The second one is, why do you think any of us write? Why do we tell stories? And the third one is, why do you write stories of the fantastic specifically? So, in whatever order you like.
All right. Well, I will do them in the order you asked. I will ask you to rephrase those questions as well, because I will have forgotten what they were by the time I get to them.
Okay.
Why do I write is the first one. And a lot of people I know, a lot of authors I know, say they write because they have to. If they don't write, they're going to go crazy. They're going to go insane. And that is not my answer. I write because I enjoy it. I love the creation and the development of characters and the world building it's a mental exercise that I love doing. Could I go without writing? Yeah, probably. Will I be happy about it? No. I enjoy the process. I really, really enjoy the process. That being said, I enjoy having written more than the actual writing as well. So I'm a complex person. How's that?
That's a very common affliction among writers.
There you go. And the second question was?
Why do you think any of us write? Why do we tell stories? Why do we make stuff up as human beings?
Why do we make stuff up? I think I'll couch that in our current times. When times get difficult and tough, whether it's COVID-19 or the politics south of our border or whatever is in the world or whatever is stressing you out or hurting you, people want and need, most people, not everybody, but people want and need some sort of escape. And even if that is escape can be as depressing or as painful as the real world, it's an escape from where they are in their lives and where they're at. It gives them a chance to, whether they live in your main character's skin for a while or whatever, it gives them a chance to escape from reality, without the use of psychotics.
And the third question was, what was the third question? Oh, why, if you're going to tell stories for people to escape into, why make it stories of the fantastic fantasy science fiction?
Because it's what I love to read. I actually, when I started out, I never even thought of writing a different type of book. It's just, it's what I love to read. It's what I love to write. Although I also love to read thrillers, and although I've tossed around the idea of writing a thriller, I don't By the time I'd be finished writing the thriller, it would have too many, fantastical things in it to be considered just a thriller. So.
Yeah, whenever I've tried to write something else, there's always, but if I put a ghost in here, this would be really cool.
Yeah, I could put a griffin right here and that would be fantastic.
So you've mentioned that you are, I guess, writing the third book. The second one is in revisions and the first one is out. So that's what you're working on now?
Yep, I'm working on the third book. And again, the whole COVID year and some of the politics that have been happening have made it a struggle for me to be creative. But I am working my way through it, and I will hand this one in on its extended deadline.
And what are the titles of the second and third books?
Okay, so it's Threader Origins is the first. Threader War is the second. And Threader God is the third.
And do you have roughly what the release schedule is?
I have no clue. I have not heard the release schedule on anything but the first book, which, as you said, just came out.
And do you have anything else in the works beyond that? Are you already looking beyond?
I do. I have an idea. And usually I wake up with these ideas in the middle of the night and scribble them down on a piece of paper. And in the morning, it feels like I'm reading a doctor's signature. So, and the idea is gone from my head. So what happened this time is the idea came during the day, but I was in the middle of doing writing on Threader God. So I emailed the idea to my agent, and now it's up to her to remind me when it's time to work on it.
And don't you've got a little short fiction as well, aren't you? I think for an anthology that's coming up.
I do. I have, what's the title? It's called Derelicts by Zombies Need Brains. I'm one of their anchor authors. That doesn't mean that they'll actually buy my story if it's garbage, but I'm hoping they enjoy it. I handed that in probably January 1st or 2nd, I think. So a couple of days beyond the due date when it was due, but they will get to reading it and I will get my editorial comments on those and I think that book is, I don't have a release date on that either, but if they accept it, it's my third short story sale.
I'm in another one that was kickstarted at the same time as that. That's why I asked. So I turned mine in before the deadline. Haha. Not too far before the deadline, but I did.
Yeah, how's that full-time job working for you?
Fair
I'm
enough.
Sorry, that was harsh. I'm sorry.
Fair enough. And where can people find you online? I mentioned it off the top, but we'll mention it again here at the end.
All right. Well, I'm at GeraldBrandt.com on the web. I'm on Facebook as Gerald Brandt Author, and I'm on Twitter at Gerald Brandt.
And we should mention that's Brandt with the DT. You have the DTs.
It is a silent D, so yes. Yeah.
BRANDT.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're not sure of the spelling, you can look at the transcript.
Exactly. Thanks so much, Gerald. It's been great chatting with you. I've thought about it for a long time. I have to limit the number of DAW authors I do, though. I have to space them out because I could easily do nothing but DAW authors because I've met so many of them at DAW dinners and stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast. I had a great time.
And best of luck with the trilogy. And I'm sure I'll talk to you again soon, or hopefully we'll see each other in person again soon. That would be nice.
I can hardly wait to actually meet people again. This is dragged on long enough, but I think we're looking at probably another 6 to 9 months before something happens.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, okay, maybe World Fantasy in Montreal.
I hope so. Yeah. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Gerald for being my guest on this episode of The World Shapers. Another great conversation. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Just want to remind you once again of where you can find The World Shapers online. You can find it at its own website, theworldshapers.com, where you will find a complete archive of past episodes, most of which also have full transcripts, including the one you just listened to. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com. My online shop for autographed books is edwardwillettshop.com, My publishing company is ShadowpawPress.com, and you can buy the ebook of the Shapers of Worlds anthology featuring guests from the first year of this podcast directly from ShadowpawPress.com in ebook form. You can also buy the trade paperback, although to be honest, I can't compete with the free shipping you can get through Amazon and places like that. But if you'd like it directly from me, autographed, you can get that through ShadowpawPress.com as well. You can also find me on Twitter at eWillet and Shadowpaw Press at Shadowpaw Press. You can find me on Instagram at Edward Willett Author, and you can find me on Facebook at Edward.Willett. So once again, thanks so much for listening to this episode of The World Shapers. Lots of great guests coming up soon. I've recently set up an interview with Jane Yolen, for example. That'll be quite a ways down the road. There's an interview coming up with Walter John Williams, and many other great interviews. So do please keep coming back to listen to The World Shapers and learn more about the creative process of the authors whose works you have enjoyed over the years, or discover new authors whose works you will enjoy in the future. And finally, once again, I just want to say that The World Shapers is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. Thanks so much for listening. Bye for now.